You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we get a media columnist take on how members of the news media are and ought to be covering the actions of President Trump post-election. Now, Governor Evers released a package of legislation on Tuesday related to the COVID-19 pandemic, including things like requiring insurance companies to cover coronavirus testing and treatments and extending a ban on evictions. Hours later, Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss talked about things he's interested in working on, like doubling contact tracing here in the state. The last time the legislature passed a COVID-related bill was in April, and the governor and Republican leaders haven't spoken since May, after a leader of the state Senate backed away from the ideas proposed this week. Any legislative action on the pandemic looks less likely. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the inaction in the state capitol for much of the year? Do you want to see the legislature work on a COVID-related bill? Do you want to see the Democratic governor and Republican legislative leaders work on something? If so, what? What is one thing you want to see passed by both chambers of the legislature, signed by the government? What would you like to see in effect right now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Mordecai Lee is an emeritus professor at UW-Milwaukee and a former state lawmaker. Mordecai, good to have you back with us.
Thank you, Rob. Glad to be here.
Well, divided government is a fact of life in the state right now. Divisive government has been a fact for some time now. Are you surprised, though, that we haven't seen more cooperation given the severity of this COVID-19 pandemic?
Rob, in one respect, I'm not surprised based on where American politics and Wisconsin politics is going. But on the other hand, I am surprised that here, this is the worst public health threat in 100 years. And they can't get together. They can't work it out. They don't want to have a sort of a unified front. It's really distressing.
Now, we've seen former Governor Tommy Thompson, now interim head of the state university system, give a very strong, consistent message to smash COVID. And he's been smashing, you know, watermelons, birthday cakes, things like that. Looking back to an era like under Governor Thompson, with divided government, with Democrats in the legislature, I don't know, would we have done better? Would we have had more cooperation in those days?
You know, Tommy Thompson's conception of being a good governor is very different from what we're seeing from the state legislature right now. Tommy felt that about one-third of Wisconsinites were always voting Democratic, one-third were always voting Republican, and one-third were independent swing voters. And he based his governorship on appealing to those moderates. And so he had a very constructive agenda, and if he were dealing with Democratic legislators and they wanted to suggest negotiating or compromising, he was perfectly willing to compromise. In his world, half a loaf was better than none. And to the legislators who are Democrats, it was the same thing. Now we're living in an era where compromise is a dirty word, where the Republican Party has sort of become the party of Dr. No. And the motivation is partly based on the politics of the situation, that they want Governor Evers to be a failed governor, and partly based on the policy of it, and that's that they don't believe in government controls. And so everything is just falling by the wayside. I thought your introduction was just spot on.
Are we at a different time, though? It's not one-third, one-third, one-third. It's maybe 47% vote Democrat, 47% vote Republican, and that remaining 6% is all that's up for grabs now. Are Wisconsin voters different? Is that what's driving this now?
Yeah, you know, that's such a great comment. And there was a CBS Network news poll about a week and a half before the Wisconsin election. And, you know, they went through the usual and they got the usual numbers exactly as you stated them. And then the very last question, they said, generally speaking, how do you consider yourself? Do you consider yourself largely Democrat, largely Republican, or largely moderate? And believe it or not, it was one-third, one-third, one-third.
Huh.
In other words, nothing has changed below the surface, but everything has changed above the surface. And so we're in a situation where a compromise is viewed as a dirty word. Compromise is viewed as losing. Compromise is viewed as selling out. And it's just we're at a frozen situation. And I think when you use the numbers like 47-47...
I mean, I just kind of made that up. But it's pretty close.
That was generally what all the polls showed for the last 2 months before the election, is that we've got a legislature that, because it's so maldistricted, that you've got members of the majority and minority parties who are from one district parties, and they really don't care about public opinion. They really don't care about moderates, because for them to get reelected, all they have to do is win their partisan primary. And so you've got a leadership and you've got a membership that really don't care about appealing to moderates. They only want to appeal to their base, and that's how they'll get reelected.
Talking to Mordecai Lee from UW-Milwaukee, looking at action and inaction on COVID-19 here in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. I want to give a listen to a couple statements this week. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, first of all, gave a press conference this week to talk about areas he's open to working on. Here's a little bit of what he had to say.
Republicans want to make sure that we are very clear in our messaging. We want to find ways to work together with Governor Evers. We think that some of his ideas are certainly workable, some are not. But I think that's the point of negotiations, that we put out our best ideas, he puts out things that he supports, and we see where common ground can be found to hopefully get a bill proposed and passed as quickly as we can.
Are you optimistic, Mordecai, that that can happen, something that can get passed, agreed on, and done quickly?
Well, you'll notice that his attitude was that the governor needed to know what they wanted, and this is what they wanted. In other words, he was not saying, I'm willing to take half a loaf of what the governor wants, even if I don't like it, because I'll get half a loaf even if he doesn't like it. So it's a very different approach to negotiating. It sounded almost like a kind of a veto of, we're willing to talk about this, we're not willing to talk about anything else. We want to be ideological purists, and we believe in small government. And it seems to me that that's a really good political platform if you want to run for election, but it's not a good government platform. And I'm glad you mentioned Tommy Thompson, because Tommy had two phrases. He said that sometimes he was in campaign mode. In other words, once every 4 years, he was running for re-election. But the rest of the time, he was in governance mode. In other words, he was for good government. He was for getting things done. I really get the impression that there is no such thing as governance mode anymore, that we're just in permanent campaign mode, and that everything is positioning in politics.
Let's give a listen to Governor Evers now in a primetime address last week. He gave an advisory executive order, no requirements, though. He talked about the economic side of the pandemic amid concerns that, you know, any kind of shutdowns hurt the economy. Here's a listen to what he had to say.
Each day this virus goes unchecked is a setback for our economic recovery. Our bars, restaurants, small businesses, families, and farmers will continue to suffer if we don't take action right now. Our economy cannot bounce back until we contain this virus.
And we've heard messages of economy versus controlling the virus. Governor Evers saying we have to do one to do the other.
Well, that's exactly it. And it's a good reminder of what Joe Biden campaigned on and what President Trump campaigned on. For President Trump, keeping the economy open was the number one agenda. For Biden, it was getting control of the pandemic. Now, half of Wisconsinites agreed with one, half agreed with the other. But nonetheless, it really surprises me about the lack of pragmatism to find solutions. In other words, it's better to look good than it is to get things done. And maybe one way to focus on this is on the Tavern League. And I'm not putting them down. Some of my best friends own taverns and so on. But for the Tavern League, the only thing they care about is being able to stay open. They don't want to do masks. They don't want to do occupancy limits. They just want to protect their economic self-interest. So it seems to me that what Governor Evers faces is that he gets nicked, you know, from all directions by these sort of narrowly focused, don't upset my apple cart kind of attitude. And then when you've got an ideological control of the state Supreme Court, it really prevents the governor from doing what reading the plain law seems to say he should be able to do in a public health emergency.
Let's bring on a caller. Claire is with us in Appleton. Claire, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to bring up, Claire?
So I kind of just wanted to mention just how much I agree with the problem of Republicans not interacting with Governor Tony Evers' orders and leadership, and just how basically the inaction that is happening right now, it will lead to like in just a permanence in lives that are lost, and those lives are not going to be able to be contributing members of society. And with all of the fear and trauma that happens from like losing these people, we will just as a state suffer so greatly that it's just so sad. So I guess what I really think is that Republicans and Democrats need to work together so we can learn who or like how to trust and follow just what Governor Tony Evers is asking of us. And to do so would be to help the economy like be able to recover eventually. So,
Claire, thanks a lot for the call. Life or death, Claire is saying in that. Do we see that sense of urgency, though, Mordecai?
Well, sometimes I would tell my students that the best way to deal with somebody who disagrees with you is to see the world through their eyes. And so while I'm sympathetic to Claire's perspective, it seems to me that what we have to put on the table is that the way the world looks to Republicans, the way it looks to the speaker and the members of his caucus, the majority leader and the members of his caucus, is that what they're doing is politically rational, that it makes sense based on how they view the world, both the politics of it and the ideology of it. And so I'm really not sure how to break the deadlock. It really does seem frozen.
Thanks a lot for that call, Claire. We're talking to Mordecai Lee, emeritus professor at UW-Milwaukee, former state lawmaker. We're looking at the political standoff in Wisconsin over COVID-19-related legislation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see the governor and state lawmakers work together? What do you want them to accomplish? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Mordecai Lee, professor emeritus at UW-Milwaukee, former state representative and senator, looking at the politics of COVID-19 in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see from the governor? What do you want to see from Republican leaders in the state legislature? Back to your calls now. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was going to ask Dr. Lee, are we having a problem with the districting of of our representatives? I mean, is it so hyper-partisan that the people who get elected are only the very, very fringe of each party rather than people who have to answer to both sides and are more willing to compromise? So is it the redistricting that goes on every 10 years that's leading to this problem? Charlie,
thanks for the call. I've heard that argument, Mordecai. You were kind of alluding to that earlier. What do you think?
Well, let's take, for example, Speaker Voss. He's not only the Speaker of the Assembly, but he's an individual state representative. And Democrats threw, what was it, $250,000 against him in Milwaukee television advertising, and it barely dented, you know, his win. In other words, he's there not to respond to the moderates or the swing voters in the way that, say, Tommy Thompson did. He wins re-election by appealing to the base. In this case, I guess we would say the conservative ideological, or maybe we call it the Trump base. These are the people who are not interested in compromise and believe in ideological purity. So Speaker Voss is not only being a rational politician as the speaker of the entire assembly, but as an individual state representative.
Thanks for the call, Charlie. And the same thing, given the way district lines are drawn, might be said, I imagine, about people in safe districts on the Democratic side of the aisle.
Absolutely. Now, the statistic that people talk about is that you could have a majority of voters statewide casting, let's say, their votes for Democrats, but a majority of the assembly seats would still be won by Republicans. I think that's a pretty good rough indicator of malapportionment. Now, the other thing that's related to that, Rob, is the state Senate. It seems to me the state Senate is a slightly different animal than the state assembly. And you've noticed that the speaker is much more visible than the outgoing majority leader, soon-to-be Congressman Fitzgerald, or the incoming majority leader. And I think it's really important to focus on just plain raw numbers. In other words, if you're one of the majority of state representatives in the assembly and you don't agree with Speaker Voss and you fall off for a key vote, he's still got a majority. But so in other words, one individual assembly person is not all that powerful. But in the state Senate, where you've got 33 members and you've got a majority of Republicans, each individual state senator could threaten a majority. And that's why the majority leader has to be responsive not just to sort of the middle-of-the-road senators, but to the absolutists as well. So there's less flexibility for the state Senate majority leader to do compromise.
Thanks again for the call, Charlie. We'll go to Sarah now in Milwaukee. Sarah, hello.
Hi. First, let me say hi to Mordecai.
Hi, Sarah.
Some of my questions have been kind of answered here, but I just wanted to know maybe what the governor can do. You know, if the other actions have been the legislature has gone to court to say the governor doesn't have the power to say do a stay at home or other actions, and so it's the legislature claims the power. Now they haven't done anything for months and months. Is there any way that the executive branch, the governor, is there any possible ways they can kind of act on his own again, maybe fully expecting the legislature to take him to court, but in the meantime, we would have some action?
Sarah, thanks a lot for the call. And the governor this week, Mordecai, extended his mask mandate, which is being challenged in the court right now. So we'll see how that can go. What tools are in the governor's toolkit to do things on his own?
You know, I think the governor has a personality that's different from a lot of the politicians who dominate Wisconsin politics right now. And that's that he doesn't like to fight. He doesn't like to argue. He doesn't like to posture. He sort of would prefer to get things done. And so, for example, when the state Supreme Court ruled against him a couple of months ago, he knew that anything he would propose to the Joint Committee for Review of Administrative Rules would be struck down. And what was the point of going through the process? On the other hand, there are politicians in Wisconsin politics who just thrive on conflict and sort of are willing to go to the nth degree. Now, we're in this odd situation. I think Sarah summarized it well, that what we learned in high school civics is that how a bill becomes a law is that the proposal, the idea, has to be passed by the legislature, and then a governor gets to sign or veto it. And then, of course, a legislature can either sustain or override a veto. I think we've got everything right now in Wisconsin upside down, because it's almost like the governor is the guy who's proposing and trying to enact policy, and it's the legislature that's vetoing him. And so he's got the court vetoing him, and he's got the legislature vetoing him. My only suggestion based on Sarah's ideas is, does the governor have any emergency powers that he can use that are not related to public health? In other words, on the books, can you find other powers of the governor using his executive powers, not his statutory public health powers, to get something enacted? And maybe that's a way to break through how everything is stalemated right now.
Thanks for the call, Sarah. Talking to Mordecai Lee, political scientist from UW-Milwaukee, looking at state action and inaction on COVID-19. Let's go now to Dan with us in Janesville. Dan, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
What do you want to bring up, Dan?
What I want to bring up is we as individual Wisconsinites, we understand how the COVID spreads. We understand what we need to do to stop it. And I guess my question would be more to the audience than Mordecai would be, what can our elected officials do to enforce this to make it go away? They really can't do anything. It is on us as individual citizens to make it go away. You know, if we get government involved, the only way to really make it go away is they have to mandate stay at home for 2 to 3 weeks, and if you are caught outside of your home, you are arrested and put somewhere until you, you know, for two or three times.
Dan, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. Not too much time left. Mordecai, Dan saying maybe it's just consistent messaging and a bully pulpit. He doesn't see much of a role for actual government action, though.
Well, Dan is describing a scenario that's happening in Western Europe right now, in the European community. You know, they're really getting tough, and they're getting really, really serious, and then trying to snuff it out, for example, the way in the United Kingdom. But, you know, Dan is talking about how the political system is not being responsive. You know, one of the emergency valves of politics is recall. Recall can only be done when somebody has been in office for a year. They tried it against Governor Evers. It didn't work. Dan is suggesting that citizens who are unhappy with, let's say, their legislator, whether a Democrat or a Republican, if the person in the state Senate has served for already a year in their term, gosh, you could try a recall if you disagree with them.
Do I remember you're not a huge fan of recalls, Mordecai?
Oh, Rob, I'm sorry you have such a good
I've talked to you for too long, yeah.
No, but seriously, I'm against recall. But when things are as bad as they are today, as we've been talking about, gosh, do we have to go to these emergency measures?
Well, Mordecai, there's supposed to be a meeting, it sounds like, between some Republican and Democratic legislators and the governor, I think, tomorrow. Do you think, briefly, something's going to come out of that?
The key word is compromise. I'll give you half of what you want if you'll agree to half of what I want. Things can get done that way. That's how Tommy Thompson did it.
Mordecai, thanks a lot for joining us again.
You're welcome, Rob.
Mordecai Lee is an emeritus professor at UW-Milwaukee and a former state lawmaker. He joined us for a look at the politics of COVID-19 in Wisconsin. Governor Evers and Assembly Speaker Robin Voss both talked this week in public about areas they want to work on. Getting anything passed, though, into law will still take negotiations, and the state Senate would have to get on board, too. Coming up, we talk about how the news media is talking about President Trump's actions and statements since the presidential election was called for Joe Biden. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, Native American voters may have played a big role in swing states in the presidential election, including Arizona and Wisconsin. Join Jen White for a look at Native American voters and the issues they're watching. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, leading up to this year's election, President Donald Trump skirted the question of whether he would accept its results if he were not declared the winner.
Will you commit to making sure that there is a peaceful transferal of power after the election?
Well, we're going to have to see what happens. You know that I've been complaining very strongly about the ballots, and the ballots are a disaster.
I understand that, but people are rioting. Do you commit to making sure that there's a peaceful transferal of power?
We want to have get rid of the ballots, and you'll have a very we'll have a very peaceful. There won't be a transfer, frankly. There'll be a continuation. The ballots are out of control. You know it. And you know who knows it better than anybody else? The Democrats know it better than anybody else. Go ahead.
That was Trump speaking back on September 23rd in the White House briefing room. Here we are. Trump was not declared the winner, and he has not accepted the results as he was foreshadowing. News media outlets have already been reporting on the negative impacts of Trump's refusal to concede to President-elect Joe Biden. Biden has not been able to receive crucial intelligence briefings. His team has not had access to federal government resources to set up a transition or get a leg up in terms of taking over managing the coronavirus pandemic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think different news media outlets have been doing so far since the election was called for President-elect Biden? Have they given Trump a fair shake when it comes to him asserting legal rights to challenge? Or do you think they're overcovering unsupported and unsubstantiated claims? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Margaret Sullivan is media columnist at The Washington Post. She's been thinking a lot about the coverage of Trump's post-election actions and statements. Wrote a column recently on the topic. Margaret, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. It's nice to be with you and your listeners.
Well, can you lay out for us the challenge facing news organizations when we've got the president, the incumbent president, not recognizing the results of the election?
So the challenge is to figure out sort of how seriously to take this is, you know, and to determine in some way, like, what's going on here? Is this really an effort to, you know, is it a coup attempt? Is he going to try to, you know, undermine the election and assert that he won in a landslide, as he continues to do? Or is it kind of a game on his part that is intended to undermine the truth of what's going on, as opposed to actually preventing the election results from taking effect? So, you know, it's hard to say at times. I think the President Trump does know that he lost, but, you know, he's not admitting that. And so we have to kind of figure out, we meaning the media writ large, have to figure out how to frame this, you know, whether to take it seriously or whether to do something else.
Well, there's such a wide range of actions going on, from a recount, a partial recount here in Wisconsin, which is exactly allowed under state law and is a legal option for any candidate, to wild, unsubstantiated claims of an international hacking conspiracy. I mean, is part of the story here sorting out one from the other?
I think so. And, you know, I think that the attitude of Megan Wolf, who I just heard, is a great one. You know, she said she's looking forward to proving that and showing that the election was completely well carried out. And in fact, you know, given all the fears there were that this would be an election in which there would be fraud and you know, interference from foreign adversaries, it actually turned out to be a safe election and a well carried out election. And thankfully, I think for the state of the democracy, not a close one, because if it were a close one, like we had in 2000, you'd be seeing a far different situation. And I think a more dangerous one happening.
There's a lot of criticism, I think, of the media sometimes for what people call both sides reporting. You know, the model might be one side says tax increases would be good. The other side says tax cuts would be good. But if it's a case where one side is claiming fraud, the other side says it isn't, what's the duty of the media in that case?
Right. I mean, I think we have to be on the side of the truth as much as we can determine it. And one of the ways that gets undermined is by equating things that don't actually deserve to be equated. You know, equating something that is provable, truthful, verifiable with something that's simply a false claim, and writing a story or broadcasting a story that says, well, this side says this and this side says this, and we leave it up to you, viewers and listeners and readers, to figure it out. I mean, that's not actually very helpful. And I mean, I think an example of this is climate change. You know, we know that climate change is happening. There's really no doubt about it. So if you write a story that says, well, there some people think there's climate change and all these others over here say that that's just simply not true. And if you leave it like that, this kind of equal sides for unequal things, you're really not serving your audience very well.
Talking to Margaret Sullivan, media columnist at The Washington Post, talking about media coverage of the post-election period with the president not recognizing the results of the election. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What are you seeing in the media that you follow? What would you like to see that you're not? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. A tricky thing in the media, Margaret, is, I think, you know, if we set up a statement, such and such politician said an unsubstantiated thing or made a false claim, a lot of the audience is going to hear that and say, wait a minute, that's biased against my candidate, whoever that might be. How do you allay those concerns that that media people might have, that they're just going to tick people off by saying that?
Right. I mean, I think if you can show, not tell so much, it's helpful. If you can, you know, give numbers, if you can quote credible sources by name, you know, to the extent that you can bring forth the evidence rather than saying something is baseless. And also, that language gets weakened very quickly. You know, it's like unsubstantiated, baseless, whatever. It sort of starts to sound the same to our ears a lot. So I think we have to do as well as we can to, you know, get as close to the truth as we can and explain it and excavate it and put it out there. And, you know, the media can't do everything, and it doesn't do everything very well, but we can do that much, I think.
And we have two big phenomena in the media right now. There is a huge web of websites and social media platforms and elsewhere really spreading false stories, things that have been debunked a week or so ago by the other thing I'm bringing up here, fact-checking sites that have gone through and debunked claims and posted articles about it. And the false stuff, as from where I'm sitting, is spreading a lot faster than the fact-checking side of things. I don't know, how much is it the media's duty to go out and pursue the false information out there and try to level the playing field?
I mean, there's a whole system of disinformation, and it's like a fire hose of bad stuff out there. And it's, you know, fact checking can be useful up to a point. I actually wrote a column at one point saying I wasn't sure how effective it really was. I think it's necessary without being sufficient, you know. So it's hard to chase all this stuff down, and there are so many sites and people now who are magnifying bad information, and it's going to be believed, at least by some. And I think when it's repeated ad infinitum by, you know, people right up through the president and his tweets, it's a great propaganda technique, is repetition that may have some truth to it, a grain of truth, and a lot around it that's not true, and repeat, and magnify and give it a platform. I mean, it's very troubling.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Mark is with us in Sauk City. Mark, hi.
Hey, how you doing tonight?
Good. What do you want to bring up?
I guess I keep hearing on the media how they about President Trump conceding, and that we're still going through verifying the ballots, and then they keep saying that he's not accepting the results, and they said you can't accept the results until after the final counts are in. But yet they keep stabbing him in the back and saying he won't accept it. He's like, accept what? They're still checking ballots. They're still finding stuff that wasn't counted properly and machines that messed up some votes. I mean, the numbers aren't what he wanted, but he still can't accept the vote until the numbers are in. And the media keeps sitting there stabbing him in the back and saying he needs to accept.
I gotcha, Mark. Thanks a lot for the call. I'll give my experience going back to 2016. I anchored our election night coverage sometime after midnight. The AP projected Wisconsin for President Trump. That put him over the edge in the Electoral College. That's when I started calling him President-elect Trump instead of Republican nominee Donald Trump. There were still counting to do. There were still legal challenges. But at that point, he was President-elect Trump, and obviously that held firm. And that's the same standard we're using now, Margaret, in 2020, I think. Is that, I don't know, consistent?
No, I think that's right, that the votes have been counted. The states haven't all certified the votes, so it's not completely official. But we know what the vote count is. And, and so in some cases, there are some recounts. As you said, two counties in Wisconsin that are undergoing recounts. It would be extremely surprising for that, and unprecedented, I think, for those recounts to materially change things. In other cases, recounts have, you know, changed a couple hundred votes or something like that at most. So the results are the results. You know, you may not like them, and the president may not like them, but we're quite sure that that's what's happened.
Thanks a lot for calling in at 800-642-1234. Margaret Sullivan is with us, media columnist at The Washington Post, talking about media coverage of the post-election period. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What media are you following? What kind of things do you like in the coverage? What do you not like? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Margaret Sullivan of The Washington Post about how the news media is covering the statements and actions of President Trump post-election day. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your comments and questions. Back to your calls now. Jody is with us in Monona. Jody, hello.
Hi, I actually had a couple responses to things that were said. The last caller, he failed to realize that Hillary Clinton conceded and President-elect Trump got the money and was able to start with his
transition, right,
and get things going. And, the other one was, I liked that your guest said, show me, don't tell me. I think they have to have a lot more talk and a lot more visually what's happening, because I don't think people have heard so much and they hear so much that it's a little bit overwhelming. And as far as covering Donald Trump, I think they should be strongly covering him golfing and hunkering down and at the White House. This is a man who wants TV time every day.
Really, Jody, I got you, Jody. You're kind of fading in and out. Thanks for the call. Margaret, your thoughts on, the president is still the president, on coverage of his actions now as president.
Right. I think, we only have in the United States of America, we only have one president at a time. And he indeed is the president and is so therefore, we need to cover what he's doing and what he's saying, but we can put it in context. We can say he's saying something that's not true. We can put it in historical context. But your caller is absolutely right that a lot of people are finding it hard to know what to believe because there's so much coming at us all the time. And I think, there's mistrust and distrust in the media, and sometimes for good reason, because there's a lot out there that's not very good and not very true. And one of the reasons for that is that local journalism has suffered so much, and local journalism, local newspapers, for example, have been more trusted, and they're weaker now. Their business model has really declined. So that's one of the underlying factors that has hurt our ability to have kind of a common basis of facts that we all deal from.
Thanks a lot for the call. We'll go to Steve now with us in Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I want to echo something, not the previous call, but the one prior had to say. And I will say, and this is all due respect to both of you, but both your answers were kind of disingenuous. Joe Biden said during the debate that he would not declare himself victor until the final votes were tallied, all the canvassing, everything was done, and it was official. Those were his words. Those were his official words. So why would you hold him to a different standard than Trump? Why aren't you condemning him for saying he's president-elect when he said he would not do it until everything became official?
Thanks for the call, Steve. I don't remember the exact words in the debate, Margaret, but your thoughts on what Steve had to say.
Well, I don't remember those exact words either, but, I think that we have a process in the United States that's been going on for many years, many administrations, Republican and Democratic, and it's pretty much the same every time, which is that we count the votes, we have some kind of reasonable consensus that this is the case, and when that happens, sometimes it's on election night, usually it's on election night, sometimes it's a couple days later. In the case of the 2000 election, it was weeks later, but that was a very unusual case. We're not in that situation right now. There is no real question. There is no real question at all. And about what has happened with the votes. They've been counted. They are real. And so, you know, it's past the time when every other president-elect has been able to have a transition going on that allows for a peaceful and useful transfer of power. So, you know, I don't know what your sources of information are there about the votes are still in question. They're really not.
Thanks for the call, Steve. Talking to Margaret Sullivan, media columnist at The Washington Post, about coverage of the post-election period right now. Margaret, I wanted to talk to you about another column you wrote, actually, about the relationship between a president, any president, and the media. President Trump, a famously contentious relationship with the media. But in your piece, you talked about President Obama and his investigation of leaks and targeting of members of the media. What would you hope for a better working but still adversarial relationship between presidents and the media?
Right. I've been very critical of President Obama's relationship with the press as well, as you say, because the way he pursued and prosecuted journalists and was not transparent the way he promised he would be. So what I'd like to see in a Biden administration is a lot of access to legitimate news sites. I'd like to see truthfulness from the briefing room, and I'd like to see accountability. So that would be something of a return from the Trump era. And, you know, America has always been a beacon of free speech and press freedom. And that has declined very badly, especially in the past 4 years. I think we need to get back to that. That's one of the things that distinguishes the United States of America and makes us special in the world. And it's something that we want to, you know, I think, guard and cherish.
And you mentioned also earlier, Margaret, and this is something I know you've written about as well, the decline in local media, local newspapers in particular. Do you see any hope of rebuilding that?
I mean, I'm really troubled by it, as you know, and I'm sure your listeners do too. You know, for the past about 15 years, newspapers have been in a serious decline, really, because their main lifeblood for revenue, print advertising, has gone away in the internet age. I mean, that's simplifying it. There's no silver bullet on this, but I really feel like we need to shore up these institutions because they are so incredibly important to our democracy.
And as in our last minute or so, Margaret, can you give some advice to our listeners as they read whatever media they read to, I guess, be smart media customers?
Right. Well, it's really important to be able to, I think it's really important to compare and contrast. Don't just have one news source, but if you see something, you might want to check it somewhere else. I mean, that's a lot of work. It's too bad we have to do that. But I think finding news sources that you believe to be verifiable, that do legitimate kinds of work, and then sort of reading across the spectrum a little bit will help you be a good news consumer. And we all really need that right now because it's pretty confusing out there.
Margaret, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Been talking to Margaret Sullivan, media correspondent at The Washington Post. We talked to her today about how news media outlets are covering President Trump and his actions following Joe Biden being called the president-elect. Still time to share your thoughts. You can email ideas at WPR.org, and you can always tweet us at Central Time WPR. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 7:30, childcare centers in Wisconsin and around the country are facing some big challenges during the COVID-19 pandemic. Join Kate and her guest for a look at how those centers in the state are coping with COVID-19 and still trying to provide the care that parents and kids are counting on. That's tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then many conservatives have been expressing fear about an incoming Biden presidency, but our guest columnist tells us why he says it may not be the disaster they're bracing for, especially, he says, if Republicans can hold on to control of the U.S. Senate in the Georgia races. 8 tomorrow on Central Time. It's this week's edition of Food Friday. Our guest says he can help us cook fearlessly in our home kitchens. Find out what he means by that and how to work with great flavors. That's tomorrow on Food Friday. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.